Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello everybody, Andy Burt here. Welcome along to our latest episode of the Early Excellence podcast. This week we've picked out an episode to re-release that will really get you thinking about your practice and provision. So here you go, here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with Evan McCormick as we talk all about inspiring outdoor learning. Thank you very much for coming along and to join us on the podcast. It's great to have you here. Welcome along, first of all.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be joining you on the Early Excellence podcast. I've listened to it throughout my career, so it's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, it's good to have you here. So I thought we'd start off. We're going to be talking about communication and language, which, of course, is such a big issue. In schools up and down the country at the moment. So for so many people, when you talk about actually what's your key need, what are the needs of your children on entry? For so many people, that's what they'll talk about first of all. And of course, it's key. And so we're going to have a conversation, aren't we, about really some of the offering some support. So the sorts of things that people can do to support communication and language development within the EYFS classrooms or within their settings. We're also going to be talking a lot about, about the links between communication and language and other areas. So why it's important. And we're also going to focus on some additional needs as well. So lots for us to talk about, lots for us to really get to grips with. So I'm really looking forward to it. Before we just get started with all of that, would you mind giving us a bit of an introduction, telling us a bit about yourself and your role at Leeds Trinity? Would that be okay?
Yeah, that's perfect. Thanks, Andy. I'll talk about my previous life first, if that's okay. So what I did before, I was a lecturer at Leeds Trinity. So I'm a former phase leader for early years. I was phase leader for early years at Old Moat Primary School, which is a member of the CLIC Trust in Greater Manchester. So it's a really great trust. It's doing lots of great stuff in terms of research and research informed practice. But a little bit of context about Old Moat. It's got well above average SEND, EAL, and pupil premium. So at a times challenging place to work, but a really rewarding place to work. And when I became lead, and remembering that I was NQT there as well. So whenever I became lead, it was a good opportunity to rethink the practice that we are actually using in thinking of children's starting points. We believed that there needed to be a really strong focus on communication and language. So we implemented various strategies and a curriculum that really emphasized communication and language. I know we'll come to some of those strategies later. And as part of my role at Old Moat, I was also the practitioner for early years across Trust itself. So that role involved me supporting EYFS development in schools within the Trust and outside of it as well, actually. And the most interesting part of that role for me and the biggest learning curve that I had was getting to know schools' varying demographics and staff and resources even, and coming to the realization that I'm sure you're aware that one approach doesn't always fit all schools, and you really need to think about the context and what you want to achieve with your cohort of children in the early years. So at the beginning of this academic year in September, I made move into academia and I became a lecturer at Leeds Trinity. And my teaching areas and research areas are EYFS and English. And specifically at the moment, I'm involved in two projects which center around using picture books to teach about social justice issues So the first study that I'm involved in is empowering student teachers themselves to choose culturally diverse and representative picture books. And then the second study I'm involved in is exploring the content and use of LGBTQ picture books. Two areas which I think are really, really important. But what I try to achieve with the student teachers that I have, for only a couple of hours a week, it's not very much time they spend in university, but you're trying to give them that knowledge of curriculum, policy, and educational theory, but then also the confidence to in themselves interpret that curriculum, policy, educational theory, and have the confidence to think of practices themselves that they can implement.
Yeah,
whenever
it's such a combination of different things that you're aiming for, isn't it? Yeah, understanding, knowledge, skills, confidence, as well as that kind of, in a way, the sort of the personality to be able to put all of that together and put it across and to fit within a team within school and everything else that goes with that. It's, yeah, there's such a lot to what you're doing.
Yeah, 100%. It needs to go beyond a surface understanding. It needs to develop a level of criticality, don't they? Because we know that educational practices change, they adapt with time. What I learned in university, as I'm sure the case is for you, is very different to what they're learning now. So we need to equip the student teachers with the ability to adapt and really be critical of policy and practices that they see and come into contact with.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And it's similar to what we talk about actually with young children, isn't it? That when we're talking about our role as teachers of young children in the UIFS, we talk about not just the sort of the knowledge and skills, but actually what underpins all of that. So you've got the kind of those characteristics of effective learning, which of course include the resilience and that kind of, say, resilience for change, you know, so that in a changing landscape, that as, you know, as we have new things, new challenges, actually children or young people will rise to those. And yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's not just about the most obvious things that you're going to be teaching your students. Yeah, interesting stuff. Okay, so you made that move from being in schools and having that EYFS role, EYFS leader and leader across the trust, then into university and university life, which strikes me as quite a big move. Yeah, really interesting move.
Yeah, an interesting move, and there are so many similarities actually in terms of engaging students, whether they're young learners or indeed learners in their late teens or their early 20s and beyond. So there's many practices that I've just carried over. But of course, it has been a lot of learning for me since September as well.
Yes, yes. And I should think that the students really appreciate your very much up-to-date experience in the classroom. You know, really sort of enjoying you sort of saying, well, actually, this is what I was doing this time last year with my group of pupils. You know, that very much immediate, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that experience is really helpful. And being able to talk about the challenges that schools are facing at the moment and the challenges that they are coming into contact with whenever they're on the school-based training, having an understanding of that, the pressures that are currently in school, I think is really important.
Yes, yes, definitely. And it's, of course, when you were the EYFS leader in your previous role that I met you, isn't it? I mentioned just before that I met you quite a few years ago now. It doesn't seem that long ago, but sort of, you know, I don't know whether you have this, but with the pandemic, you know, what, 4 years or so ago, it kind of skews your idea of time or your kind of impression of time and how time has passed. I kind of think, well, actually, I probably met you probably about 3 or 4 years ago in my head, but actually it can't have been. It must have been, it was definitely pre-pandemic, so it must have been more like 5 or 6 years ago, I would think.
Yeah, it's definitely funny how COVID changes your understanding of time. But yeah, we met whenever I had asked for consultancy from Early Excellence. You came in and you supported with outdoor development. It was an area of focus that we'd want to work on for a period of time. And I think that there's only so much that you can do without funding. So there's a couple of years where we didn't have any funding to actually develop the outdoor area. And we were doing our best in terms of developing resources, getting objects from the community and resources from the community. But when the time came for a big investment, you came and you supported us with that. And that experience was so beneficial for my later role in going into various schools and supporting with the early years development and outdoor developments as well.
That's brilliant. Brilliant to hear. It really is. Let's really move into then that focus for this particular session, this particular podcast episode, and that is communication and language. Okay, so let's start with a kind of, I suppose, a straightforward place to start would be communication and language skills. Why are they important? Okay, you know, why are we talking about communication and language? Why is it a focus for so many schools and so many settings? So can you kick us off with that? Would that be all right? You know, why is it so important?
Yeah, well, communication and language is, of course, an area of learning, but I think it's really important to remember that language is so much more than just learning. Language isn't solely about learning. Children learn language at home, and they'll come to us with a certain level of language, and they'll continue to develop language outside of the early years. So language has cultural, societal importance, doesn't it? It's how we relate to each other. It's our everyday interactions. So it's really important to remember that it isn't just an area of learning. It's how we interpret the world. And it's important in that respect. So keeping in mind as early years practitioners that language has huge complexity. And we know the children might be learning multiple languages. They might be communicating in using body language, whatever it is. So it's a huge scope. And then communication and language as an area of learning itself, well, it's important because policy says so. We have to use the EDIRS framework as our foundation. And it says that language forms the foundations of cognitive development and underpins certain areas of learning, which it absolutely does. So then us in early year settings, well, we need to be giving a heightened priority to communication and language. It needs to be on everyone's mind. And so if listeners think about, well, does my setting give heightened priority to communication and language? They might say yes, but unpick that and think of what does that actually mean? So how often do children talk to each other? Are they given opportunities to talk throughout the day for a range of purposes? How often do your staff reflect on communication, language development and provision? What are your actual strategies to support communication and language development for everybody? Also provide support for those that are needing some additional support. So while it underpins the seven areas of learning, that's really clear. We need language in order to access learning within the areas and going into Key Stage 1. It relates hugely to school readiness. I'm sure listeners will be really, really aware of that. But we also know that the link to literacy is really key and strong. We want children to be confident communicators so that they can become confident readers and then writers. But I guess that those areas don't develop in isolation. I think that sometimes when we think of communication and language as a prime area, it's sometimes treated like children master it and then move on to literacy learning. But they absolutely need to be developing communication language skills throughout the early years, not just stopping in the nursery when you might have your carpal times, focusing on communication language. It needs to be an active part of reception and key stage wall life as well.
Yes. And of course, all of that requires, in terms of the practice, it requires a real focus, doesn't it? You know, in order to achieve that process of putting communication and language right at the heart of our practice and really valuing it, I think we've really got to think about a number of different things. We've got to think about our ethos. We've got to think about our staffing. We've got to think about the skills that our staff have. We've got to think about the time and how we use our time within the setting. You know, adult time, how is adult time being used? We need to think about a wide range of different things, don't we? It's also about routines, isn't it? You know, we can get into habits. I often see, and when I work within schools and settings, I often see certain habits that are formed, you know, where actually we are having certain interactions in certain areas of the classroom and perhaps not in others. Certain habits that will form in terms of indoor interactions compared to outdoor interactions, that there is often a difference between the two. So I think it would be really interesting to kind of start from the very beginning of actually, if we're talking about really effective practice around communication and language, and we're talking about kind of planning for that, if you like, and I mean planning in the broadest sense of actually really engaging and creating a vision for what we're aiming for, what does that include? What sorts of things would you recommend if one of your students says, well, what am I aiming for in terms of communication and language? What do you recommend?
Well, like you point out, I think an often overlooked area of practice is our daily routines in the early years. It's sometimes undervalued. Routines aren't just about transitions and getting children to move from carpet to play and back and forth, going to lunch. But there's such value in those moments. So daily repeated routines are in a stripped back timetable where you're not trying to go above and beyond with too much crammed into your day, but valuing those communal moments that you're spending together with your class. They have such value for developing children's communication and language. Because the familiar structure that you might use using the same timetable daily, it creates security and consistency for pupils, and they're able to repeat and build on same conversations day by day. And the routines that I'm meaning here are like, for example, visual timetable. And the visual timetable, I know that most schools these days do have them in the classroom, but think about how are you actually using the visual timetable? Is it just something that you refer to in the morning that the teacher leads with? Or are you actually referring to those symbols, maybe using British Sign Language to support it and really getting children throughout the day to refer to that visual timetable, maybe even taking lead with delivering the discussion around the visual timetable. Another routine is settling in the morning. What do you do around register time? Do you quickly do the register and then go off to do phonics, or do you really appreciate the time you have together on the carpet? So you might have discussion about the weather, emotions, maybe asking children what they have for the breakfast, how many children are present today. And then it's not the same conversation that you're having daily, but if children have done that for 2 years throughout the foundation stage, then the conversation in the beginning of nursery in September should be really different to the conversation that they're having when they leave in reception. So it's a really great opportunity to plan how you're going to extend children's vocabulary within those routines. Yeah. One of the most revolutionary routines that we introduced at Old Moat was plan, play, review cycle. So before the children go off and play in their continuous provision, then they had to plan what they're going to play with, what resources they're going to use. Are they going to play with another child? Lots of topics to talk about. And then whenever they return from their play, they have to share what they've achieved, share what they've enjoyed. And again, it's the same conversation twice a day, but such a great opportunity to extend vocabulary. And some people might say, how boring having the same conversation daily, but really it's never the same conversation. It's the same routine, but it's never the same conversation. And children are so engaged and engrossed, and because they want to impress you with their vocabulary, with their extension of language. So yeah, I think that routines are really, really important.
Yes, they are key. I mean, that sort of that plan, do, review kind of structure, which is based on the high scope approach, which includes that kind of structure, is one that I often recommend, because it's so simple, isn't it? The beauty of it is the simplicity of it, that what you're doing is providing time for talk before and after the children have had opportunity to play, and you're really providing a structure in which you're encouraging that conversation, that talk about what they're going to do. And although it might seem difficult at first, you know, it might seem stilted at first, children might not respond to it, keeping going with it and children knowing that this time is coming means that actually they start to prepare for it. They start to think, well, actually, what am I going to do today? And afterwards thinking about, well, actually, how did it go? And what am I going to do next then if I go back to this tomorrow? And I think it helps to provide that language of progression of what you're going to do next, of how you're going to build on it, so that the activities that children engage in are not one-offs. They're not things that we just do once, that's it. But actually, there's a link between what you've done today and what you're going to do tomorrow and how you're going to carry it on. And at the start of the day, well, what did you do that yesterday? Are you going to carry it on? All of those sorts of conversations, I think, are really valuable. But also, I think it provides that structure for conversation. Because with the best will in the world, adults can't be everywhere at once. You know, you've got so many children, maybe 30 children in the class. Of course, we want adult interactions with each of those children. But you can't be in every area of provision. You know, even within one day, you can't really be in every area of provision each day and to be having those conversations with every child.
Yeah, I completely agree. And then, yeah, when you have these conversations with children, you can then hear them having those conversations together within the provision. What resources are you using? Can I help you? I think you should do this. So like you said, it can take a while to set up. I do remember that, but persistency and practice is really, really key to the plan, do review cycle. And then another strategy that we really worked on whenever we were developing communication and language provision at Oldmoat was, what are adult interactions and what are the purpose of adult interactions within the continuous provision? So what does it actually mean to interact? Because it's not just about questioning or observing children, but actually being at their level, both physically and mentally to a certain extent, and understanding them as individuals and really valuing their voice and what they're saying, and thinking about how you can progress their language in that way. And I think that sometimes those child-led interactions, because that's really what we're talking about, if you're listening to their voice, it's really child-led, it can be more difficult than adult-led interactions. It can be more difficult than saying, you three, come over to the writing table with me, we're going to do this. It can be much more difficult. But to be successful in those adult interactions, I think if you keep in mind that you need to model and extend language, and also as well as extending language and modeling new vocabulary, it's about those other communication behaviors. So are you actually actively listening to the child or children you're communicating with? Are you giving them eye contact? Are you taking turns or leading the conversation? Can you pull naturally other children into the conversation that you're having? Because sometimes you see practitioners in the provision with their heads down, a child comes over, talks to them in their ear, they respond, but there's no contact there. There's no two-way communication. So keeping that in mind, I know we're all busy, but making time to really connect and communicate with children will go a really, really long way. And then, Mike, you suggested earlier, you have to be really aware of who you're interacting with. So we know that some children need more support in learning, and they will naturally receive more practitioner time. I think that needs to be the same for continuous provision and play as well. So who's being supported in the continuous provision and why? How are you keeping a track on that? Because interactions are teaching moments and they're also intervention moments.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think that word intervention actually it has some connotations. I think quite often people will take an intervention to mean that actually we are taking a child out of the setting, you know, to out of the room or into another space. When actually an intervention, as I think you were suggesting, actually can just as well take place within your areas of provision, can just as well be working alongside children in the water area, if that's the area that actually is their favourite space to be in, and that's the space where they seem to be most comfortable and most engaged, then actually that's the best place for you to support them in developing language. And you can bring your skills to that.
Yeah, and I think as well, for those children that do need a little bit of extra support, then other children are your greatest resource. So it's not a one-on-one play. That's intervention. It's one on two or three or more. It's having other children involved, hearing those other children using language, using them as the model can be really beneficial. And I think if you don't keep track on who is receiving those interactions, and I'm not meaning a tick list. It's about having conversations with your team, not necessarily a tally number. That's not what I'm suggesting, but you need to be aware of who is receiving those interactions within the continuous provision, because otherwise it'll be the same children that are pulling practitioners' attention, and they're often more confident children. So I really do think that that's something that practitioners need to keep an eye on by talking with your team.
Yes, absolutely. And that is the sort of thing that we can very easily not notice. You know, we can kid ourselves as teachers and practitioners that we're having conversations all of the time, but actually some children will be getting far more of those conversations than other children. And weighing that up against need, quite often it's the children who perhaps need that less, you know, to a certain extent. They've already had adults who are engaging with them, perhaps. They've already, you know, developed those skills in terms of conversation, whereas probably the children who are less confident, who've had less or fewer experiences in that way, positive experiences, possibly will not seek them out. Will be elsewhere when the adults are in certain areas of provision because they're not confident in interacting with those adults. So yeah, it's weighing that up, isn't it? The different needs of the children. I think it's a really interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, it's about finding a way that's manageable for you as a teacher, as an EYFS lead, to keep a track on that. We don't need to be keeping a tally list, but it's talking about children regularly and making sure that they're having those interactions. And then something else we really worked on in terms of developing communication language provision was actually looking at the provision itself, so the continuous provision itself. So what opportunities are actually offered to children. And we had quite a large investment on open-ended resources. So, for example, loose parts, transient art area, natural materials, junk modelling. Because those resources, we know, they encourage creativity and imagination, and often children's language can go much further with those resources than if it's a very closed resource. If it's a man or a firefighter figure, then that's all it is. But if it's a little pig, then it can go much further. It can be much, much more. It can be more creative with those resources. And then once we had a really solid continuous provision and we knew it was working, then we started to think about what provocations and enhancements we were actually offering as an additional layer of why we were offering it. What actually interests children? Is it something that they actually want to interact with, discuss, observe, hypothesize about? And that was all about responding to children's interests, really, and keeping that open-mindedness in mind.
There's such a lot there, isn't there? Once you get into it, there's such a lot there to support children in terms of communication and language, from the routines that you have in place, as you were just saying, to the continuous provision and how well it's planned for, to the adult role and thinking carefully about where adults are within the room and who it is that they're engaging with, the materials, the resources that are on offer, and whether those resources provide a language-rich environment for those children. All interesting stuff. I would also add to that, I think displays can be a really great way of supporting children in terms of communication and language in amongst all of that other stuff too. You know, so things like photographs that will prompt the children to talk about their experiences, things like a written recording of what children have said, you know, celebrating the voice of the child within the room. I think, again, are all things that can really support speech, language, and communication skills, as well as really build children's confidence as speakers. Yes. So things like helicopter stories that I've talked about before on the podcast, you know, a great way of sort of scribing for children's stories, valuing children's stories, and really at its heart, you're valuing children, aren't you? You're valuing the voice of the child.
Yeah, absolutely. So scribing stories is such a great practice that can be used, so whether it's whole class and then group, and even individually within the provision, because it fosters that confidence and creativity in a way that expecting children to compose and write at the same time cannot. So it's a practice that's really focusing on communication, language, storytelling, rather than the writing. Of course, you will be modeling writing, which is still important, but you can really hone in on the skill of storytelling and forming stories. A really great suggestion, really great practice.
Absolutely. Which actually brings us quite nicely onto what we were going to talk about next. We were going to then talk about that idea of, I suppose, the links, really, you know, of which there are many between communication and language skills, and actually, you know, across those other areas, across the different areas of learning. And of course, there are clear links with literacy, as we've just suggested, in terms of stories and storytelling. But of course, there are lots of other links as well. Would you be able to share a little bit about that? Would that be okay?
Yeah, absolutely. So like we said, communication language really underpins the seven areas of learning. The language is the medium in which children learn best. They need to have solid footing in communication language as a prime area in order to be successful going into key stage one. And the links, like we said, to literacy are at the core of that. Language development is the foundation of early literacy. So our role as practitioners is to really give children a solid footing in communication language so that they can be later successful with their phonological awareness development, beginning to read and write through phonics in reception year and then going into key stage one. So absolutely, the link to literacy is there. It's really clear and really important. But communication language absolutely links to the other areas of learning as well. So a really significant link with personal, social, and emotional development. because we need language as humans in order to build relationships, have self-confidence, be able to regulate our own emotions, to have empathy with others. And I know a lot of listeners will know that there's a growing trend in school with children having emotional needs and being dysregulated within the classroom. And having a focus on language for those children is really, really essential. And the best way to do that is by providing time to play, promote interactions. So if you've got a cram-packed timetable, those pupils that are having difficulties with their emotional needs, maybe it is that they need more time, the continuous provision, in order to make sense of the world and develop the language. And there's many ways that we can equip children with the language around emotion and social development, whether it's through story, modeling, having those explicit conversations, zones of regulation schools often use. So capitalizing on that, having a really clear picture of what you're offering children in terms of the language around PSED is really important. And then another really key link for me is mathematical development. So I often think that maths sessions in the early years are some of the most rich sessions with communication and language. It's never purely just a maths session. It's so much more communication and language, absolutely links to mathematical development. And it goes beyond just learning the mathematical vocabulary and understanding concepts like size and shape. It's one thing knowing the words tall, tallest. Mathematical development is about problem solving and explaining concepts and thinking. And it's really, again, capitalizing on those experiences that you give children in order to use language to explain and reason is really, really important. So building in as much communication and talk into your math sessions and also in the continuous provision is really, really important. And then going on to understanding the world, the links to understanding the world are really pertinent as well. And we know that language facilitates understanding of the world. Language helps children make sense of the world around them. But what I think the most interesting part of language relating to understanding the world is that often the provision relating to understanding the world tends to be hands-on, experiential, exciting, engaging, going outdoors, getting really hands-on and involved. And those experiences actually facilitate language development. So it's back and forth between those two areas in terms of development. Really igniting curiosity and wonder in what we're offering children in terms of provision for understanding the world can then in turn really develop their language.
Yeah. Well, what I'm meaning for really is that sort of holistic view, isn't it? You know, that sort of, I think when we appreciate that effective teaching in the early years is very much about holistic learning, then we start to notice things. We start to notice things more. So we start to notice the communication and language within mathematics teaching. We start to notice that when children are playing on a big physical scale, that isn't just about physical development, but that's about actually often about communication and language because they're having to work together in teams as they're doing it. Or it's about mathematics because they're also problem solving as they're working things out. And I think we, when we see each of the areas of learning as separate entities, we often then end up missing key parts that actually could be really valuable.
I think whenever you appreciate what child experiences whenever they're in their provision environment, if they're going off to, say, the creative table, they aren't thinking it's time for expressive arts and design. That isn't what's on a 3, 4, 5-year-old's mind. They are developing all skills at once. So, like you said, we need to see the child as whole, but then we also need to see our curriculum as whole. So a maths lesson in itself, some children might already be solid in those mathematical concepts, but they've made really great progress today in a communication language skill, and that is absolutely okay. And then it's the same for the continuous provision. So if a child is going to the writing area or the mark-making table, and they're drawing a picture and they're talking confidently to their friend about it, they want to share with an adult, then that isn't a problem. Just because they haven't written any words today, then we need to really foster those opportunities and not stop children from accessing areas of provision just because it doesn't suit one area of learning, because that is our idea as practitioners, not what children are experiencing themselves.
Yes. Yeah. No, completely agree. Completely agree. Of course, within any class, we are then going to have, of course, children who have specific needs. And I think it's only right, really, that we focus in on children with particular needs, with specific needs as well, because, of course, it's bound to be the next question from any early years teacher or practitioner who's listening along to this could easily say, well, yes, but what about this child? What about the child who's got English as an additional language? What about that child, meeting that child's needs? Or what about that child with developmental delay or whatever it might be, whatever that barrier might be or difficulty might be? And so I thought we'd, just as a final thing to cover, really, I thought we'd talk about those specific needs and what key considerations we need to have. So to really, what key considerations we need to have put in place, really, and reflected on as part of our practice alongside communication and language.
Yeah. So the children we've taught in my career have mostly been EAL, and a high number of SEND as well. And you have to recognize within those two categories, there's such great variation, isn't there? So there'll be some pupils who are classed as EAL that are actually internationally arrivals and might have any language at all. But then there's other children that potentially spoken two languages at home from close to birth. And then in regard to SEND pupils, there might be children who have came to you with needs identified, and then there might be pupils that don't have any needs identified before they arrive in your setting. And considering that picture and the variation within it, then that leads me to really focus on the universal provision and universal offer that we're providing with two children. And going back to the familiar routine and the daily conversations we talked about, that can be really, really helpful for EAL, SEN pupils, because they're not having to be introduced to a new activity each day. And they can really build on the conversations that they're having. Then considering communication-friendly practice, building in visuals, British Sign Language into your everyday provision can suit everybody, not just EEL and SEN learners. They might really benefit from it, but all children will too as well. And then within that, the provision that you're offering needs to be adaptable. So you need to be able to make adjustments to suit individuals and make sure that your staff are on board with an understanding of how to do that. And I think important to say as well is that whenever you're considering the provision that you're offering to any child, then it's important not to have a deficit view of them, and to really think about what the child can do already. Recognize if we're thinking about communication language, recognize how they're communicating and building on that. It might be verbal or non-verbal. but it's our job to start from their starting point. And again, a one approach won't fit all in this regard. But of course, even with that universal provision and that universal offer, there will be some children that need even further support. And I think schools, and for this, just have a really tight understanding and tight protocol around identifying needs and then planning support. So how do you actually identify the needs, the language needs of the children within your cohort? And that starts, I think, with practitioners' understanding of children's language development. So what is expected of children and when? And being able to identify when there are major concerns. Of course, keeping in mind that not all children are the same and don't necessarily develop in such a linear pattern, but you need to be timely with the support that you're offering, and getting to know your children is really key there. A lot of schools use language assessments to help with this. I've used Welcome previously, a really helpful diagnostic tool to see if there are major concerns with children's language development. But this can't be the sole data that you're using. You also need to use your understanding of the children, and interacting with them in the provision, I think, is the best way to get into that.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just jumping as well. I was going to say as well, I think a really clear understanding of the developmental stages of the children in terms of communication and language, but also in terms of generally when you would expect each of those stages to happen. And I know that actually, of course, you see a difference in terms of certain developmental stages, not always a straightforward line in terms of progression and development, but that actually having a decent idea of when you'd expect different developmental stages to happen for young children, I think actually is important. Because otherwise what often happens, if staff don't have that, what you often tend to find is that the support tends to go in reception for children who actually, when you look at the children's ages, it's often the youngest children who are getting the support. And which may be absolutely appropriate, but it may not be. You know, it seems a little bit too convenient to me that actually the support goes to the youngest children. When actually there might be a child who is 6 or 9 months older than those children, and therefore on the face of it, developmentally, they're ahead of those children, of course, and their need doesn't seem to be quite so great, but that actually they're further behind than those children, but it's not as obvious because they're older. They're that bit older.
Yeah, absolutely. So you'll have a variation of a year within ages within your cohort. And a year is a huge portion of those children's lives if they're 3, 4, 5. And so you absolutely need to appreciate and understand their ages and the rough stage of development that they are expected to be at. And again, it won't be a clear linear path for all children, but having, like you say, an understanding of the stage that they should be at will help you to identify any concerns in terms of language development, and being timely in that support is really, really important. And liaising with professionals is key there. So talking to your SENCO, sharing concerns early, and then seeking speech and language support if it comes to that, if it's felt that the child needs that, then it should be done timely. And then in terms of the support that you can offer in class, if you do have concerns with children's and communication and language development, well, there's more formal interventions schools often use. NELLI is a common intervention. I know it's highly regarded by the EDF. And there might be interventions that come from the speech and language service and the local authority. With these, it's important to really think about how often children are being taken away from their learning, though, I feel. So what time in your day are you offering children that intervention is really important, because we don't want to take them away from, say, their interactions with children in the provision, because like we talked about, those interactions are actually really helpful for their language development. And I think that's where more informal, targeted support in the provision can really, really go a long way. So practitioners, all practitioners, understanding individual children's needs in terms of communication and language, how you're going to extend their language, and ensuring that those children who are needing extra support are getting equitable, an equitable level of interactions within the provision. So keeping in track and making sure that there's opportunities to extend those people's language in the provision. And also sharing with parents and getting parents support and setting them manageable targets, providing example activities that they might be able to engage with at home can also go a long way as well. But again, I go back to the idea that you need to value what these pupils have already achieved and not having a deficit view of them, but recognizing their starting points and building from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Gosh, we have covered a lot of ground, haven't we? We've talked about the classroom environment and continuous provision. We've talked about routines. We've talked about the adult role and adult engagement. We've talked about plan, do, review kinds of structures. We've talked about displays and valuing the child's voice. We've talked about the holistic nature of the early years, and we've also talked about specific needs, English as an additional language, and of course other needs and developmental stages as well. That's a lot to cover in one podcast. Evan, it's been brilliant to talk to you. It's been lovely to talk to you and to kind of share ideas and share thoughts around communication and language development. I'm sure people listening along will have found it really, really helpful, really useful. In a way, there's nothing new, is there, in terms of early years practice necessarily. It's about key principles and kind of and really knowing the depth of what we need to be aiming for here. But it's always interesting to talk it through and to really think through, actually, you know, what are we aiming for in terms of effective practice? So, yeah, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Andy.
So there you go. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you found the episode useful. Now you can stay in touch with all things Early Excellence by joining our mailing list and also, of course, following us on all of the social media platforms as well. Okay, have a good week, everybody, and we will see you next time.